the Jays. And welcome back to Dr. Drill's Making Motivation Podcast, where it is our mission to honor interesting and authentic people, to tell their motivating stories, to inform the listener, the viewer, and put some smiles on faces. And in the process, we also like to put a little fire under the asses of the masses. Today, I've got a great friend from my childhood in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey, my friend Dee Callahan. Okay, she's a commercial artist, and she's going to here to tell us all about her life. Dee, how are you today, my friend?
Good. How are you, Aaron?
I'm wonderful. I'm very happy to see you. You look beautiful.
Thank you.
And I can't wait to tell everybody your story. So let's start with an attention getter. You told me just a few minutes ago about an experience you had as an artist, as a fine artist, as an art teacher. This is right around the time of 9/11, 2001.
Yeah, so I was working at a company called Image Dog Media, and the company basically laid all of us off. It was like that July or August, I want to say, and I worked there for like 2 years almost, and they were like, yeah, well, we don't need you guys anymore, and basically we heard the company was going under. So what happened was the owner took a bunch of funds and put it into a startup. And we were there for like 10 or 15 years. And I thought they were in a startup. That's why I felt comfortable working with them. And Pfizer was our client. So we did all the graphic design for Pfizer. They laid us off and they wanted to hire us back on as freelancers. And I was like, well, oh, so you don't have to pay, you know, and I was a wise guy. I was like 25 or 26. And I was like, oh, so you get out of paying health benefits. You know, I was like, corporations like that, you know, corporate America, I was done with. So sure. There was a teaching job through Catholic schools. And I was like, I kind of helped out with a Catholic school the year before, my old grammar school, St. Peter's. And so they were like, we're hiring a lady at Libra. They need an art teacher part-time, like 2 days a week. I'm like, well, I could do that. And I was like collecting unemployment to pay my rent because, you know, they laid us off and I had student loans. So I had to do that. And I taught part-time at this Catholic school and it was kindergarten through eighth grade. So I was about to start the week after 9/11, and then 9/11 happened. That was like a Tuesday, I think. And it was devastating. You know, I was living downtown Jersey City. I was living in my old neighborhood I grew up in. And, you know, I saw my roommate called me and I was supposed to get up to go to the World Trade Center to do my resume. I mean, literally downtown Jersey City is like less than a mile from lower Manhattan where the towers were. And I was going to go to Staples and I was like going to print out my resume, you know, because I was like still looking and I was like, well, I'm only working part time. So I told my roommate and she was like, do you want me to wake you up in the morning? I said, yeah. So she was like, Dee, I'm going to work. And I was like, nah, just sleeping. So she went, she worked up in Midtown. And I was like, okay, I'll sleep in. And, you know, and she called me. She goes, Dee, did you go into the city? It was like 9 o'clock or something, or 8:30. And I'm like, no. And she's like, we're being attacked. And I was like, Kim, what are you talking about? And she's like, no. And I'm like, what? And then I turned on the TV and I saw the plane hit. And I'm like, oh. So are you kidding me? So we had like a cordless phone. So I walk outside because my apartment, you could see the towers right there. I mean, we're right on the waterfront. And I'm like, oh my God. And I saw it on fire. And it looked like a candle melting. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? And she's like, yeah. She goes, I'm stuck in the city. They have everything on lockdown. So I run upstairs and, you know, and that was my whole 9/11 experience, you know, just seeing who's alive and, you know, I calling people like, oh my God, you're not in the city, like calling family, like, is everyone okay? Called my dad. I was like, I'm okay. I didn't go in the city. Like, you know, we're just trying to network. And we actually opened up a bar down the street. They were like, open up downtown Eddie's. And we all went in there and we're like, we can't leave downtown Jersey City. They blocked us off. So, you know, then at 10 o'clock when I walked down to the waterfront where I grew up and I saw the towers fall, like I saw them crash. It was like terrible. It really affected me. I was really upset because, you know, I grew up looking at them and I grew up like I used to walk through there to get to the other train to go up to Midtown when I worked with the Image Dog. So it was really just And then being a kid and my childhood memories, going there with my dad, just getting the lottery ticket on like a Thursday, we would just, you know, take 5 minutes to go over there. Like it was nothing. I knew more about the World Trade Center than in lower Manhattan than I did the rest of Jersey City, because that's the only neighborhood I know was downtown. And so, you know, I start teaching a week later at a Catholic school, and I was at Our Lady of Libra, and we had a little room downstairs with a chalkboard. It was the first time I ever taught art. So I was like, and it was crazy because, you know, it was the kids were all healing, and the kids would come in and I would just give them paper to draw with. And we were all like on slow motion, and the school was located in Union City on Kennedy Boulevard. So I used to have to go and take the little tiny buses. They call them jitney buses or something. And I would take that to from downtown to Kennedy Boulevard, and then from Kennedy Boulevard and Newark Ave, I would take it up to Union City. And they were the filthiest buses on the planet. They were really gross. I actually threw up one time because it smelled so bad. I was like, like, it was just so bad. But it was a great little Catholic school. It was my first experience, like really teaching. And I loved it. And I was like, I want to do this. And, you know, the kids, like I said, you know, kindergarten through eighth grade, all kids love to draw and express themselves and, you know, were creative. And, you know, the kindergarten kids were, you know, you need to have long projects that last a while. Cause if you give them something, they'll be like, I'm done. And then they're like running all over the place. And then, you know, and I realized like middle school kids are insane. And I was like over that. I was like, oh, they like are best friends in the beginning of the year and hate each other by the end of the year. And then the girl drama in eighth grade, I was like, I don't know about that. You know, somebody's crying over a boy. And I'm like, ugh. Like, it was just, I realized what age group I liked. So, you know, kids are super creative, but the healing that year was really tough. It was a really tough year in the beginning when those kids were like coming in and everyone had a story and they wanted to draw the towers, and the kids saw the towers. They could see them on fire from where the school was. I wasn't there at the time. I was starting a week after 9/11. And that's, you know, it was tough for these kids. And I have all their drawings somewhere in my garage. I saved them. And a lot of them drew the World Trade Center, and, you know, I gave them like time to just express themselves, and here's the paints, and kind of like, it was a first couple of weeks were healing, and some people had stories, some people lost people that they knew. And it was a really weird time. And after that, I was like, I want to move out of the country. Like, I was really kind of, you know, creeped out by that whole experience. And it just kind of made me look at things different. Corporate America was like, you know, when I hear stories of people running back into the towers, I was like, you know, for what? This company would lay you off in 5 minutes and take your pension fund. So what, you know, your 401k is gone. Who, like, how do you have that much dedication to that? You know, it just, so I realized I really wanted to work with kids. That whole teaching experience was awesome. One of the things I found out when I was at Our Lady of Libra is that I looked at their reading books. I was helping one of the nuns one day or get all the books out. And I was like, this was my book in grammar school. And I remember that in like first and second grade, I'm like, this was Crystal Castles. Like, it just, I came back to me. I'm like, this was my book. I remember this. I had to read all the readings. Half of it was in English and half of it was in Spanish, because my grammar school in Jersey City, St. Peter's, my kindergarten through eighth grade grammar school, which I went till fifth grade, was a satellite school for Spanish speaking students. So, which explains why I was the only non-Latino in my entire class, probably kindergarten through eighth. There was another girl, she was from Jamaica. So me and her, we were like, we don't speak Spanish. So like, you know, me and Bethany Higgins, still friends to this day. You know, people I would take a bullet for, I grew up in that little city with. And so I realized that, and years later, I found out from my friend Michelle Carpena that it was a satellite school for Spanish speaking students. So I was really, for some reason, I was like a straight A student. Like, I was like ahead of everybody and I used to memorize things. But by fourth grade, I started having some like learning difficulties. Like, I couldn't read an entire book. And then my friends were like way ahead of me. Right. They started picking up English, you know, my friend Melissa moved here from Puerto Rico in first grade. I used to do all the talking and she was like, super quiet. And then when she started to pick up English, like they all were like ahead of me. So I was like, what's going on? And then when I got to Lacey, I started realizing like, oh, I can't spell that good. I can't. I mean, I probably most likely it was like dyslexia, dysgraphia. I still have to get tested for it. I'm blowing that off. But when I work with kids with dyslexia, I'm like, that was me. I was like, I get it. I was that kid. I know what you're going through. Don't worry about it. So, that experience was life-changing, I'd say. Like kind of, you know.
What other powerful experiences have you had through doing art, teaching art?
Well, let's see. So it was, you know, like I said, in high school when I was doing, I had that algebra teacher. I won't say her name because people love her and Lacey, and she's not there anymore. She actually, I think she passed away, but whatever. God rest her soul. I don't want to speak ill of the dead. But she did not like, she told me that I would never be a nurse. I was failing her class. I tried. I had all these, like, I was set to go to nursing school like my aunts. And my dad's cousin taught at St. Francis Nursing School in Jersey City. And I was dead set to go. I was like, I was in high school. I'm like, this is what I'm going to do. And I failed her class. And I was like, oh, my God, I can't pass math. And I had her 2 years in a row. And I probably shouldn't have. I had a tutor. I had such an issue with, like, algebra. I was like, oh, my God, letters and numbers was like, oh, my God, like, torture. And it started in like eighth grade. Actually, seventh grade, Mrs. Sable found out I had a problem. And she's like, you should really take this summer school course. And then my mom would never drive me. It was just a big thing. So then I had Mrs. Eckstein in eighth grade. I don't know if you remember her.
Vaguely, yeah.
Scary. It was like, I remember just going and the classroom was gray and she was really mean. And I was like.
Gray classroom.
It was gray. It was gray. I just felt like it was scary. It was a dungeon and she was just like mean. And then. I don't know. That started my math issues. So, So I was told I couldn't go to art school. I couldn't go to nursing school. So I was like, well, I got to pick something I'm good at because everyone in my dad's family went to college. I was like, I got to do something. So I picked art and my parents were cool with it. Like my dad was kind of a hip dude. And he was just like, yeah, go for it. You know? And I was like, yeah, graphic design's like advertising. It's supposed to be really like the next big thing. And he was all about it. And my mom was like, are you sure? Like, I don't know. And then I got accepted to the Art Institute of Philadelphia and I went with it, which was, it was easy. It was open enrollment. So I was like, great. You don't have to look at anything. I got my diploma from Lacey. I was like, peace out. You know, I mean, I couldn't, it was, Lacey was not into the arts. I did teen arts, kind of like hung out with like my art friends, Tim Dupnak, John Saratniak, kind of like our little art clique.
Yeah.
You know, we just kind of did our thing. Like creative arts helped us, like especially students who struggled. I always believe that art is like a catalyst for kids who might struggle and they can verbalize and they could show their work visually, or visual learners, you know, it's their strength. Whereas some people are, everyone has a different learning style. You know, I don't like the word special education. I really like differentiated learning because I think everyone learns differently. You know, that experience of that teacher saying that to me was so hurtful. And I mean, you know, in a way, I have a great art career. Like I really enjoy doing what I'm doing. But I had this insecurity for years. Like I can't be like, you know, everyone else. And I had a different childhood. So I never felt the same. I always felt a little like, I was like a little bit of an outsider in a way. So that's why, you know, when you said I was never part of a clique, I really wasn't, but I try to be friends with everybody. Cause I, you know, knowing.
I think that was wonderful. I mean, a couple mentions on, you know, things that you mentioned that prompt in a reply for me. We talked a little bit before about how teachers can, I don't know if they get cynical or they just like say, hey, I'm just going to tell this girl that she's not going to ever be a nurse. I'm just going to put it out there. I had teachers tell and guidance counselors swear that I was not cut out for, you know, college material, you know, you need to be and work. You know, Lacey was there was a lot of big working class presence there. So, I mean, my dad was a lineman, you know, he did fine.
My dad worked on the railroad, you know, but he was educated prep school. That guy's life was totally different. He rebelled against, like, you know, his brother went the right way. He went like, I don't need to do that.
Yeah.
quit college. He got accepted in the 50s. Yeah.
But yeah. So now this is also making me feel like, because I have two, I have a 15-year-old and a 16-year-old, and my son especially, he reminds me very much of me, where he's like, screw school, man. I can't stand it. You know, this is the big drag. And I was like, you know, so I'm approaching it very delicately and trying to encourage and him to experiment and find things that work for him. But we all find our way. Just I appreciate the facilitators along the way, because at some point in time you ran across some people who obviously inspired you.
Oh, yeah.
So who was that?
I just thought I heard my door open. You know, let's see. Lacey or like in college?
The beginnings. What was the first thing you did art with? What's the first, you know, drawing or sketch or?
My dad pushed the arts. Like, I remember looking at a telephone. And he taught me how to draw the telephone. So, and my dad would come back. We'd go to New York City and he'd come back with drawings. Like, these artists would sit and they would do portrait drawings. And he would always get one of me or him. And there was always art going around because it was the 80s. So in the city, and then going on the cattle calls with my parents, I would be in photography studios. So I'd sit and I have a drawing pad and they'd be like, we're going on a cattle call. Like the modeling agency would call and I would go. And they were like, you want to go? And I was like, yeah. And I'm in these like photography studios. I remember one time my dad was there going, this guy photographed Yo-Yo Ma, you know, the upright celloist. And if you get the job, they would say, yeah. But I would sit there with a drawing pad. And my dad was also watched the Uncle Floyd Show, which was like a big kind of show of North Jersey. And he was like such a fan that we went to Sea Caucus to see them. And he had like an Uncle Floyd shirt on with like the Ramones were playing. So like, I'm trying to like paint a picture of my eccentric parents, you know, they could be called crazy, but they were kind of super educated. Kind of, my mom looked like a supermodel. My dad was this little short guy. I don't know what his deal was. He worked on the railroad. He had friends. He was like really into that. Would send my artwork off so it could hang on the Uncle Floyd Show. He would show art, kids artwork. And my dad would send my artwork there, or like, he made me draw a train and showed me a picture because he worked on the railroad. And then when I didn't win, he thought it was rigged. He was like, it's all rigged. You should have won. Yours was the best. Like, you know, stuff like that. So like, I always, you know, art was like always there, you know, except when I moved to Lacey, I didn't feel like it was, well, I kind of just got into art class, you know, after my experience in math. And I was like, well, I love art. And I got into fine art. I remember fine art one, you could take fine art 1, 2, 3, 4. So in eighth grade, that's when I had Mrs. Eckstein. I was like, I don't know about this, but I'm really strong at art. So I got into fine art one and I was super excited. And so then I realized this is my strength, you know, like this is my, you know, this is what I want to do. I don't think it was pushed as much. I never felt like the arts were pushed in Lacey as much. You know, I felt like it was like football and like everything else. And I was like, whatever. And you know, I just didn't feel it there. So I always was like, I got to move back to the city. That was my angst. And when I got to the Art Institute of Philadelphia, there was a teacher, Kim Lyles. And she was just like classy and dressed nice. And she was a graphic designer, did work for Patti LaBelle. Supposedly she dated Al B. Shore. And we all thought she was so cool. Like, oh my God. And I went to Italy, Greece, and Turkey with some of the modeling money I had left over. She got paid like $200 an hour. So when I did the Crayola ad and the Tylenol ad, I had some money saved and my aunts had some money that was in like saved up. So that's how I got my Jeep. And that's how I went to Italy when I was in college and I spent it on a computer. And she was really cool. And she went to Moore College of Art. And she was the reason why I transferred there. Cause I was like, where'd you get your bachelor's? She was like, Moore. I'm like, I want to transfer there. And in between the time of the Art Institute, I came back here, waitressed at Caffrey's, one of the original Caffrey's waitresses. Thank you.
I want to hear some stories about that.
Yeah. I was original waitress at Caffrey's. You know, and then I worked as a nurse's aide because I was going to go to nursing school because I was like, forget this art thing. And then I applied to Moore and I got a presidential scholarship. But in the meantime, Barbie Fury's mom did really put me in the really right direction. She's like, I work in this corporation. I'm really good friends with Barbie Fury.
Yeah.
And her mom was like, yeah, you know, we have a graphics department. You should work there. So I got a job working there. I think I stayed there for a year. I took like a gap year and I started working at their graphics department. It was called Keptel. And I worked for a graphic designer And that 1 year experience catapulted into like all these other things. So I got accepted to Moore, went to school for a year, quit because I was bartending and I got a job at Pitney Bowes Management Services, took another gap year and went back to Moore after that because I realized I wasn't getting paid where I could furnish my apartment, but I was doing everything. I was their graphics department. I had a network computers. They didn't have a graphics department, but one of their clients was the Franklin Mint in Philadelphia. Cool. And it was the year that they were changing the coin from the Betsy Ross coin to the Sacagawea coin. And I was the graphics department. So back in 96, like not everyone had a scanner like they do now. So scanning was like, these machines were $10,000. So only corporations had them.
Right.
Like big scanners. So what one of the sales rep did for the Mint was take the drawings from the artist. So all the mints in the U.S. have artists. There's like four of them. There's one in Philly. There's one down south. There's one out west. Maybe there's three Franklin mints that print money. But there's like art departments in them. And these artists, like, that's the best job to have. And they're elder, you know, older. They seem like there was men that were working there and the one in Philly. And all had fine art backgrounds. Would draw those coins, commemorative coins, whatever coin came out. And they had a contest where all the mints were put together. So they were changing the Betsy Ross coin to the Sacagawea coin, which came out in 2000. But they started it back in like, it was 97, I want to say. Maybe, probably 97, because that's when I was at Moore in 96. I went there in 97. And they asked me, and all I was doing was scanning the work in. And I actually got to hold the work, which was really cool. And they asked me, the artist, we did a tour. And they said, you should put a drawing in. And I was too nervous and I didn't do it. And I tell that story to my students because I'm like, listen, you only get one chance sometimes. And that I should have, you know, that should have, could have, would have. That was the one time where I should have just like, you know, decompressed and said, I'm going to do a drawing and see what happens. I could have been on the coin, like, you know, and that chance I turned away because of my own self-doubt.
Right.
You know, like if I just believed in myself a little bit more and did that sketch, I would have done that. You know, I would have, you know, been able to do it. So anyway, one of the coins, actually one of the artists in the Philadelphia Mint was the now Sacagawea coin that we see all over the dollar coins. And we're like, oh, look at that. You know, the baby with the backpack. And that was a neat experience. But when I realized I was kind of being taken advantage of, I think I was making like $14 an hour and I couldn't pay to furnish my apartment. I went back to Moore. Worked there, you know, finished up school, did an internship in Manhattan with an artist named Mike Kwan. And I was like, when I come out, I want to work here again. So I finished school, got the job in Manhattan, moved back to downtown Jersey City in my old neighborhood. And my parents were dying. They were like, are you kidding me? I'm like, I'm back in the old hood. Like, I moved back and, you know, and went back there and started working in New York City. And I worked for Mike. I did a lot of interesting stuff for him. But yeah, Kim Lyles was one of my favorite teachers. Mrs. Sable in middle school, Lacey, one of my favorite teachers who realized I had some kind of dysgraphia, dyslexia.
Right.
Really caring. Super caring. There was another English teacher in middle school. Middle school art teachers I loved. They were so awesome. Because I went to this Catholic school where we had this nun who would yell at us for an hour and not teach us art. And we had to do calligraphy. Oh my God, Sister Carmel. I couldn't stand her. And then when I got to Lacey Middle School and was like, oh my God, great. Like, it was like, we're doing real art projects. And, you know, I have another funny story, not to go back. Yeah. Anyway, that's my graphic design career, but I want to get back to school. Like you said, when I moved from the city to Lacey, and we had recess, the first day of recess, right? Now, recess for me was a parking lot with parked cars, and we couldn't run like and hit the cars. Like, it was like Catholic school nuns. They had a bell they would ring. We didn't have automatic bells. They literally, it was like something out of the 1950s.
Oh, Lord.
And, you know, we had slippery shoes. You would fall. It was like, you were taking your life in your hands at recess in the city. It was like cement. Like, we didn't play in. So I remember the first day of school at Lacey, and I sat in the parking lot, and the teacher's like, are you okay? And I'm like, I can run out there? And they were like, yeah. And I'm like, what do you mean? And they were like, no, you could run. Like, and I would just see the kids like running, like, ah, you know, like out in the woods. And I'm like, and it was like, you know, that field. And I'm like, we could just run in the field there. And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Wide open spaces.
And the teacher's like, are you okay? And I'm like, no, I just didn't like know that this was a thing. And I just started running like, hey guys, here for me. You know, like they're like, what is wrong with her?
Culture shock.
It was a culture shock.
Yeah. So that's interesting. One of the things that I find very interesting about you there, Dee, is, you know, you said you grew up in Jersey City. Mm-hmm. And then you, at the age of 10, your parents moved you guys down to Forked River, New Jersey.
Yes.
So why, now, just the background, I remember, and I don't know if you're on the Facebook page, it's Lacey Township Memories or something like that.
Yeah. Anyway,
you see that? So I remember every once in a while they'll post something. It's like a postcard from the 50s and it says, come visit the Barnegat Pines. And I can imagine like our foremothers and fathers, you know, because my grandparents were up Kearney and North Arlington. So a lot of people either came from Philly or New York and trying to find their place in suburbia, right?
Yeah. So I used to be like, how did you guys find this place? Like, I was like, where did you find, this is like Kentucky. Like, I thought, I was like, we're in Alabama. Like, what is this? We have one traffic light. I'm like, where did you guys find this place? And come to find out, my dad knew a Lacey police officer whose family was from Jersey City. And my dad knew his brother-in-law really well. And my dad knew him. They were all like in the same neighborhood. And remember my dog was like barking. I didn't think my parents knew anyone. My father was like a quiet man. He never like talked about, like, I didn't know. It takes me years to figure this guy out. And so this Lacey police officer was like, Kevin, you got to get Deirdre out of the city. Like, it was getting really bad. You know, it was like really, really bad.
Oh, the, like, 80s in New York, the 80s New York City.
Yeah, it was like, and our building was nice and we had our school across the street, and I'm looking at it as a kid. So I was safe because I was with my parents, but it was like, you know, I think I emailed you a couple of stories. I don't know if you want me to get in them now.
Yeah, we'd love to hear them. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, cool. You know, it was Jersey City in the 80s. Like, my first memory of being scared was, like, we'd go to 440 Mall. And, like, if anyone from the area is watching, like, I remember we had a car and we had an apartment and we were like, oh, you know, they're doing it. You know, my dad, like, I don't know, he was doing very well when we lived up there. And we were in a car and we went to 440 Mall, and it was like my first memory of actually being scared. And my dad looked at my mom, he went to park the car, and I remember the car getting surrounded. And I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Warriors.
I was just thinking about that when you said 80s.
It looked like the guys from the Warriors surrounded the car.
He had the bottles on his fingers. And
yeah, like, come out and play. Yeah. That's what it looked like, surrounded the car. And I was like, oh my God. And I just remember being like, this isn't good. Like, in the back seat. And my dad looks at my mom and goes, Kathleen, grab Deirdre and go and start walking. So, thank you. I got coffee. So, and my mom was like, what? Are you okay? And he's like, we'll be okay. We'll be fine. We'll be fine. So she comes and gets me. Now I'm over her shoulder and she's like walking really fast. And I'm only probably like 5 or 6 years old. Like, I was little, like, it was like my first memory. And I was like, oh my God, I could see my dad. And he's like, is surrounded. He's standing, the car door is in front of him, and he's looking at the guys. And then he leans down and comes back up and they all run. They all scatter. And I was like, and then he leans back down, closes the car and comes running back, and he's laughing. And he's like, ha ha ha. And I'm like, my mom's like, Kevin, what the heck just happened? Like, what happened? He's like, we're okay. We're fine. Just go. And he's like laughing as he's walking in. So I'm like, what did my dad do? Like, how the heck did these guys run away? Like, just ran. I mean, they ran for their lives. I mean, they walked up confident and they had chains and, like, it looked like, I don't, I don't know what this. Yeah, it was like that period. Little dude. He was a little guy. He wasn't a fighter. He wasn't a big guy. He was a little guy, like short little guy. Didn't like fights. So as we're doing his obituary, my mom's like, I knew he had a second job because he really wanted a boat. Like he really wanted a boat so bad. And my mom's like, well, he worked 30 years on the railroad. You know, we're writing down St. Peter's Prep, St. Peter's College, all this stuff, U.S. Army. And then he was an armed guard for Pinkerton. And I'm like, Daddy had a gun? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, do you remember that time when we were at the 440 Mall and we were surrounded? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, do you think that was a gun? And she's like, that probably was. Like, I'm like, there could only be one way. Like,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
He wasn't showing his muscles. Like, he was a little dude. So I was like, yeah. I don't know. You know, and so there was like plenty of, there was like a list of probably like 100 things of why Kevin Callahan moved his wife and child out of the city. And, you know, it was like, Dad, what's floating in the water there? We're at Liberty State Park. I was probably like 8 years old. I was like, it looks like hair. And I see a shoe and I see a sneaker. And my father's like, what are you looking at? And it was like, on nice days, you would take your kids to Liberty State Park.
Yeah.
And this is in the newspapers, actually. I wasn't in the newspaper, but this wasn't in the newspaper, but what happened a week later was. So I was like, I don't know. That looks like a head. And my father's like, wait. And he grabs me and he's like, that wasn't. You were looking at a dog. That's a dog. And I'm like, there's a dog in the water. I go, but there's a sneaker. Like, and he was like, he turned pale white. And then he went and he told someone else, like, don't have your kids over here. And like, he got a Jersey City cop. And then when I saw the Jersey City cop turn around, his face was pale white. So what I found out later was that it was a kid from my neighborhood that someone kind of, and the worst was knowing that it was a kid from my neighborhood. I think that was really shook me up. And that was a memory that I kind of put away until I moved back to the city. And then I was like, oh yeah. Like, you know, I remembered. Everyone's like, isn't it great? It's like, we got coffee houses. I'm like, it's still the city. Like, you still have to be careful. Like, I still had that fear in me of, you know, watch your back. Or, you know, time me and my mom went to Church's Fried Chicken and I didn't shut the door all the way in the car. She was making a right and all the food fell out when she stopped the car to get it. And someone grabbed the food and ran off with it. And then she was flipping out and we go home. My dad's like, where's the fried chicken? And he's like, my mom's like, we got robbed. Like, it was just, you know, like, it wasn't like this, you know, sweet place. Everyone's like, isn't it great? We drink wine on the waterfront. I'm like, oh my God. So I mean, it was a beautiful place too, because we had like a great community and neighborhood and church, and we were like super close. But there was a dark side, you know. It was getting unsafe, and you know, it was getting like people were being pushed out, and there was a lot of fires, you know. And they talk about the Bronx is burning. My neighborhood was too. It was a very, and my dad knew it was changing, and my uncle always said, you know, your father wanted me to invest in the neighborhood. Because he was a railroader, so he knew that they were selling all the railroad land, and that was all the waterfront, and that was all going to be changed. And my uncle said, my dad took him down there. I was like, you should invest, Brian. You know, this is, my uncle was a big executive. I don't know if you read his obituary on my Facebook, but he was like a very successful man and very business savvy. So my dad was like, Brian, you got to do this. And my uncle always said, I never did. I wish I did. You know, your dad was like new. He's like, I just bought the house and the kids were young. And so, you know, and then my father put a bid on a brownstone that was by the Holland Tunnel, and it fell through. So it was between that and this house. And I think he was just done. I think it was just like, so like, he just saw what was happening and like me and like, what was I going to do? Be a latchkey kid? Like, I didn't have the freedom of running around outside. And my mom always said, like, we didn't want that for you. So they moved to Lacey and, you know, got this little house and I still have it. I'm in it now. This is
pretty remarkable.
Callahan compound, you know. And so, you know, I used to want to run away from this place so bad, but you know, because I was like, there's so much out there. And then, you know, now I'm back and I appreciate it. Like, COVID made me really appreciate this little town, riding my bike around the lakes. And
yeah,
you know,
it was a beautiful place to grow up.
It really was. It really was a beautiful place, you know.
But it's that, so then part of the city life, Jersey City life was, there was a lot of diversity, right?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I mean, you know, being a lot of my friends were from like Puerto Rico, mostly. My neighbor was very, very Puerto Rican. Ecuador, Honduras, El Salvador, you know, everybody spoke Spanish. Like one of the things I had to learn on the playground was my mom would say, te amo, you know, what is your name? Like, or te ama. And she taught me how to speak Spanish a little bit, like just to make friends. Like it was like, so I always had that, you know, in me, like, I always liked being around, like, that's what I enjoyed about the city is like different people, diversity, you know, that, and, you know, and I appreciate the quietness of Lacey and that nice, like, you know, all these different ways everyone lives. And, you know, so the city life always intrigued me. Like, I always felt like it made me like, that's where I felt most creative, you know? So even a couple of years ago, I was renting, studio space at 313 Gallery and, you know, and that is, I still go up there and show work. And sometimes I need to be out in the city and I'll do like, you know, live painting as a DJ is playing or something like that. Like I need that energy, something about it.
Isn't that interesting how, you know, it makes me think about is like, you know, big inspiration of mine and maybe a lot of artists, right? You always see the cinematic portrayal of somebody who's like a writer retreating to some place in the woods or on the lake so they can like focus without distractions. But yet there's something about the city where people go because there's more, it stimulates you in a way.
Yeah.
That, how do you feel about both, you know, like the setting, like you, that's your roots and also the city. I mean, the Big Apple's right there. So moving and shaking. There's a lot of options. There's a lot of everything, just more of everything, more people, more, interaction versus.
Yeah, I felt like it was appreciated more, but with my landscape painting class, and I have a couple of old pictures of being out in the woods, like on Memorial Day weekend and all the trucks and stuff, I want to resurrect those. So I taught a class at Island Beach and it wasn't advertised. And I was butting heads with the director because she just thought like she promised me the world. And when I got there, she's like, no, you have to sit underneath this for 6 days a week and your schedule is going to change. And yeah, we'll put your painting. She never advertised my art class. And I would tell her like, please advertise it. It was just really annoying. But anyway, a couple of people showed and I painted and I really like appreciated that park so much. It was almost like spiritual, like painting with my, you know, out there in the you know, in the sun. I was like, oh, I love this. So that didn't work out, but I always teach at the Lacey Rec Center and I'll throw a class out there. And so last year I taught a landscape painting class at Lacey Rec and I figured like, I'll just go to the cool places that I remember as a kid that I always thought were really beautiful. And one of the things I remember having, I used to take pictures a lot when I was in art school around here in Lacey and a friend of mine, she was from Vermont and she goes, this looks like Vermont. And I'm like, no, it's New Jersey. She couldn't get over like my pictures of Lacey out in the woods and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, it could be really beautiful. And so I started shifting to Lacey and I was printing I was painting the landscape painting class and some people would show up. It didn't get busy until August. I almost made no money last year. I was so broke. I was like, oh my God, because I didn't do my summer savings and I didn't get enough people. It didn't catch on until the end. And I was like, oh my God. So it just didn't catch on. Maybe this year it'll catch on more. But I was painting the bridge at Bamber Lake. And then someone said they're going to take that bridge down and they're going to put a new one. And I go, like, what kind of new one? I go, this is beautiful. I feel like I'm in Japan. It looks like one of those Japanese bridges like you see. And I'm like, this is absolutely gorgeous. I never appreciate it. Like, you know, we'd go down there and be like, you know, hang out with your friend. You know, be like, let's go swimming in the creek. And I was like, oh. And it was beautiful. I always liked it. But then I appreciated it more.
It's like a Japanese bridge, but with little redheads riding dirt bikes around. Throwing keg parties.
Yeah, exactly. You know, man. Like skinny dipping in the Bamber Lake. Not that I remember that.
I remember Hess. I swear Hess told me that his brother caught a piranha. In friggin' Bamber Lake, like
a piranha.
He must have had it, and in captivity, and decided like, hey, you got to get rid of your piranha kid, or whether, I don't know, if they flush it down a toilet or let it go, but his son,
they let it go in Bamber Lake, and then Hess found it.
I mean, nothing surprised me. That's one thing. Nothing surprised me. All the things that I've seen in my 49 years, few things really surprise me anymore. But yeah, that's true. That happened, I believe.
If anyone's going to find a piranha, it's going to be Brian.
You know? Yeah, but there's so much beauty to be had in our, you know, in Forked River, in Lacey Township. But I could see the beauty in the city. Sometimes when you're talking about your growing up in the city and moving back and all that stuff, when I'm visiting, let's say Philly, and we're down there and you see these people riding bikes and they look like they're living there. They're going to little cafes and all these little restaurants and things. So like people actually live here and this is their day to day. And it's, you know, there's a lot of stuff. There's so much shit to do. For a young person in particular. But then I think like, I'm more kind of like a suburban or country type guy. But anyway, I can see the allure from both, but I think it's a pretty unique story, kind of unique in a way, because we were, even though many of us, like I mentioned before, I think a lot of Forked River residents kind of they migrated in from the cities, you know?
Yeah. We're all transplant. I mean, there's a few families that were from here, you know?
And they're really friggin' hillbilly.
Yeah. I knew I got caught up with them at the time and I was like interested, like, wow, like, you know, but like for me, you know, I go back to like pre-Civil War with my family in my neighborhood. So I get that, you know, I get that pride, you know, walk around downtown and be like, well, I'm from here. Like my, you know, my great, great grandfather was part of my parish. And like, you know, I like that stuff. So I like, you know, some of the stuff in Lacey when people are like, yeah, you know, like they were boat builders. I was like, oh, that's so cool. Like, you know, that kind of stuff makes me like, wow, that's really neat.
It is really neat.
You know, and like, you know, Lacey, for me, I feel like with the changes that are happening in the town, just like anywhere else in New Jersey, you know, painting it, it's a part of history. Artists make history. Like art history really shows the history of the world. Like kind of, you know, like in the 60s, you know, when people see like Jackson Pollock splatter paint, well, acrylic paint was new. And then screen printing with Andy Warhol, you know, people might think, oh, and, you know, it's just a Brillo box, you know, it's the most simple thing. But that's like, you know, that was like a medium screen printing. And he was a commercial artist, Andy Warhol. And at the time it was new. So it was like, he's using new tools to create something visually. You know, my background with like art history started at Moore College of Art, and I could go on about this, but, you know, I use acrylic paint because I was a trained illustrator at Moore and commercial artist. And so my fine art started really, I mean, I always drew and painted, but like I was a graphic designer for years and I didn't really have the time to paint. But when I lived in Jersey City and people would ask me like, well, what did this used to look like? That's when I started painting landscapes of Jersey City, because so many people would ask me. And it was probably around like 14 years ago is when I started really getting my fine art out there, because I was like, well, I'll paint what it used to look like, but you're not going to want to like it. You know, like here's a factory. Like I lived down the street from a Colgate factory. It was my last apartment, was a brand new apartment, and it was like a $1 million building. And, you know, people would ask like on our roof deck when we'd have our wine party, it's like, what did this used to look like? I mean, there was a giant Superfund site right there.
Oh, yeah.
You're paying $1 million to live a block away from a Superfund site. So I like paint that, you know, I'm like, well, here's a Colgate factory. And they're like, what? Like when I was a little girl, I would jump in puddles in the city and like bubbles would come out. And when I moved to Lacey and I would jump in a puddle, I'm like, why is it so dead? There's no bubbles. I mean, I literally lived a block away from the Colgate factory.
Really? So the bubbles were what? The compounds in toothpaste?
Yep. Or soap. They would make actual soap.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like what I would, and there was a funeral parlor down the street, and the Bermierski funeral parlor. And from what I was told by relatives of that parlor when it was open, it just got sold, so it's not there anymore, is that they would call the Colgate factory to shut one of the pipes off because the white powder would come out and fall onto their black limos. So they would ask, like, when they had a funeral, like, could you shut the pipe off so the white residue doesn't come down on one of the limos?
Wow.
Yeah. Now it's like $1 million neighborhood. I'm like, oh, well, I mean, whatever's there, I have. So I'm like, well, not going to change me, but.
God forbid.
Yeah.
Tell us about your Irish heritage. You mentioned, you're going back to Jersey City. You said, I'm looking at some of the notes you provide, like 18, the school you went to was built in 1861.
Yeah. So I'm
out of Ireland. You went back to Ireland. You went and lived in Ireland for like a year.
I did, which has to do with, it started with, this is a person from Lacey kind of catapulted this. So I'll go back to that. So 9/11, I wanted to move out of the country. My father passed in 2003, and my friend Allison Geiger, her and her sister are principals, are very smart, lovely, lovely people from Lacey. And Allison was neighbors. Allison, I met through an ex-boyfriend and his friend, her husband or something like that, whatever. We all knew each other. And she heard about my graphic design. We're at like a barbecue or something. And she's like, you should teach Vokes. And I'm like, what? And she's like, yeah, you should really. And she actually came to my house. It was like probably a week after my dad died. And I was like, yeah, you know, my father passed. I don't know. I'm kind of in this like in between. I don't know what to do. And I was living in Lacey to help take care of him with my mom. And she's like, no, here's the paperwork and apply to be a vocational teacher, a teacher of a trade. Because I didn't have a teaching certificate. She's like, you could do alternate route. You know, you have college, you have your experience. So I went to Mike Kwan because I worked with him steadily for years, freelance for him, and he signed off on my papers. And I sent that to the state. And she's like, you know, it's going to take like a year or two before you get that paperwork through. And it was to be a substitute teacher and to be a commercial art teacher. So she was in the Peace Corps. And I used to always ask her about it. She went to Africa. She's actually principal at Mates right now in Weirdtown. And she was like the most interesting person. I was like, wow, you know, I really want to do something like that. She's like, yeah, you should do the Peace Corps. But it was like too soon after 9/11. So I didn't want to go too far. So I applied for the job in Ireland. Actually, I did the AmeriCorps for a year. And then I was still waiting. And it was going to be like another year before everything went through. It was like 2 years before the state could process it because they were going from paper to technology. It was weird. So they were waiting for background checks and all that stuff. And I was like, all right. So I did the AmeriCorps in South Philly at a Voc Tech school. And that was to help pay for some of my student loans. And it was Bach Tech High School in 8th and Mifflin. Loved it. I was like, this is what I want to do. I worked in a guidance office. I like absolutely loved it. And then I talked to Allison. And then I was like, well, it's going to take another year. What am I going to do? Like work, you know, as a waitress or something. Like I was still freelancing.
Capri's. For a little.
Yeah. Work at Capri's again. Capri's was before that, though. I did that before that. So, I mean, I've just been bouncing around.
We're going back to Caffrey's, my friend. We're going back to Caffrey's.
Oh, we're
going to
go back to Caffrey's. I'm one of the OGs.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I applied for that job in Ireland, and I was waiting for my dad to pass because I knew he was sick. Once he passed, then it was like that December, and my mom's like, just go. And I'm like, she's like, here's money for the ticket. I was like, all right, I'll get a round trip ticket. If I get the job, I get the job. If I don't, I don't. And the only other place I traveled to was Italy, Greece, and Turkey, but that was like with a group tour. So I never left the country besides that, you know, that trip. I mean, I did leave the country, but it was like a tour with college. So I was like, well, I mean, it's an English speaking country, so I should be fine. Well, first of all, I can't understand what the people said the first 3 months. So I go to Ireland. The lady that is interviewing me, her name is Nolene O'Callaghan. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm Deirdre Callahan. And she was like, and you know, as Americans, we do this. We're like, my great, great grandfather. And they're just like, yeah, okay. All right. Whatever. Like, calm down.
We know.
Yeah. They're like, all right. But so they're like, Deirdre, we like the way you interviewed. You got the job. I was like, yay. So they're like, we're going to put you in a bus to Cork. Now, in the meantime, I had to wait a couple of days. So I took a tour of Dublin and I'm on the phone with my mother every day. And so she's like, what happened? I'm like, I got the job. She's like, oh my God, you know, we're all excited. And my mom's like back in Lacey and her brother's staying with her. He got divorced. So he was staying here taking care of her. So I knew she'd be fine. So I was like, I went on a tour of one of those bus tours in Dublin. Yeah. St. Kevin's Cross. My father's name was Kevin. And so he just died like 3 months, like a couple months before I went there. So I went to St. Kevin's Cross, and my mother's name was Kathleen. And my mother was a force to be reckoned with. She was a real pain in the ass at times. But so the tour guide gave a story of St. Kevin, how he was Kathleen, a lady named Kathleen was madly in love with him and would chase him around this area. And he would try to hide from her in like one of the, like, I don't know, castles. And he was trying to write the Book of Kells. And I'm like, oh my God. And I like went home and I like called her. I'm like, Mom, you'll never guess. And she like loved the story. She goes, oh my God, Deirdre. And I was like, that's so crazy. And then like, I looked at the Book of Kells, and in the Book of Kells, the name Deirdre meant mad chatter. And I'm like, you know what my name meant? Mad chatter. And my mom started laughing, and she was coughing and laughing. And she's like, Matt, guess what Deirdre's name meant? And they're like, what? They're like, mad chatter. And he started laughing. What are you guys laughing at? They're like, that's what we call you when you talk, is mad chatter. I go, oh, that's nice. And she's like, Deirdre, you're home. And I was like, yeah, I guess so. So it was pretty funny. So I get off at Cork. I go to Cork. And one of the people that met me was from Germany. A lot of Germans would work for the Simon community to learn English, and they would do a year of social work. And I just did it to do a year of work because I was like, well, I'm just building my resume.
Yeah.
So it was a homeless shelter. It was a homeless organization. And the Simon communities were started in London, and they were a place where you can not judge. So I didn't know what the people did. A lot of them were coming out of jail. And we would try to get them food and home shelter. We'd give them rough sacks on the street and get them off the street and try to put them in the shelter. And they had a really nice system over there, like where the people would transition into housing. They would stay in the shelter. We'd try to get them. You know, I was actually doing like social work. I was on the phone calling. I'd had to call London to get their passport. And it was really interesting. So it was like a year of that. And the first couple of months were hard because I didn't understand what anybody was saying. Like, they spoke English, but they spoke Irish English. And they were like, so Deirdre, what's the crack there? And where are you going? Where are you? And I was just like, uh-huh.
The crack.
Yeah. I'm like, crack.
What's a crack?
Crack is like fun. Like, what's the fun? What's the story?
What's a crack?
What's a crack, Deirdre? And I'm like,
what? Did they ever say, shut your face?
Well, that's where the North, you know, when they go understand, Deirdre, don't understand the plight of the North, you know, that's the Northerners. I was in Cork. So Cork was like, oh, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. Like, it was a little bit more different. They all have different parts of Ireland have different accents. I started to pick that up. So the Northern Irish sound different than the Southern Irish, and Dubliners are like, Dubliners would be like, you go down the street, you make a left, right? You keep going. Never ask for directions in Ireland. They will never give you. They're like, go down to the tree, and by the tree you make a left, and ask for Tom, and Tom will tell you to go down a ways, and it's up the ways. And I'm like, what's a way? Like, is it a block? Is it a city? Like, it's just,
Me and Rocco used to do that in Forked River when people would come in from out of town looking, hey, where's the freaking Caffreys or whatever? Where's the third lake? They'd be like, yeah, you go up there, and then you make a right, and you keep going. You know, give them the wrong directions, and they'd come back around after getting lost for a while. They'd be like, you little bastards.
Do you remember canoeing like Hess and them? And then we'd meet, like, somehow we'd end up with like the people who rented the canoes. Do you remember Matt and them yelling, and we'd scare them?
Yeah. Like, that was that close to the, was the place where the canoes,
We started at Hess's house, which was like miles before you got to the canoe drop off where people rented them.
The canoe drop, I think, was like, was it right before the bridge by the Cedar Creek campground?
Yes. It was
the place to the left there.
Yes.
Many times. That was some of the greatest times ever.
And they would just scream at the renter. They'd be like, get out of the bar! I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, I remember one time.
We looked like the Ozarks. You ever see the TV show Ozarks?
Yes.
I always say that's Lacey.
It is kind of like that. I remember one time me and Matt Coffey and his brother and a couple other people, we were coming down, and of course we had like Gatorade bottles full of, you know, terrible grain alcohol or something like that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we kept capsizing the canoes about halfway down. And then I remember at one point, somebody, I think it was Matt's brother, he couldn't get back in the canoe. So he was like pushing the canoe, and these girls were like, it was at like a camp, and they were like, just like canoeing, trying to get their rhythm and all that shit. And he comes up and they were frightened. So they oared him right in the face and his tooth. Remember in the canoe, remember in the cartoons when like Tom would like, he would go in Jerry's mouth and then he would open the door and slam it. And all his teeth would go. And then, so his, it was like held on by a veneer. His tooth was like, it was like a,
was it Matt?
No, it was Matt's brother. I don't know if it was Chris or, but
it was a bunch of them, yeah.
Long time ago. But anyway, yeah. But I mean,
when I was in Ireland, there was a bunch of coffee brothers that were in the shelter. And yeah. I know a group of brothers named Coffee. And but these guys are like, and they're like, really? I said, yeah, there's a bunch of brothers in Lazy Township too named Coffee. It's so funny.
Yeah, they're like, yeah, we know.
Yeah,
like, a lot of coffees around here.
Yeah,
mad chatter. So, well, it's fascinating, my friend. So, let me ask you, like, because the ticker down bottom saying life as art with commercial artist Deirdre Callahan. How is life like a medium, like an art that we can play with and manipulate and make beautiful? How can we make lives better through art? How about that? Because you're an art teacher. So what do you see? What do you see taking place in the minds of these impressionable children?
You know, like I said, I try to find their strengths, you know, and see what they're good at. Like I'm as a commercial art teacher, I'm really lucky. I have an amazing classroom. I work in an amazing district. I get to teach illustration, photography, graphic design. I tell my students, like, there might be a project that you might not do so good at, but the next project you might do really, really well at. And the people next to you might do really, really well at something. And you might have to ask them some questions. And, you know, because I teach technology, then I teach painting and illustration, then I teach like photography and graphics, and we kind of all mix it together. And, you know, I always tell the kids, like, you know, focus on, you know, you're really, really good at, like, I'm their biggest advocate, their biggest cheerleader. You know, I feel like I, it goes back to the time that I taught at Our Lady of Libra in West New York, New Jersey, not Union City, West New York. And, you know, where everybody is creative, everyone's an artist. So I know that when the kids take my class, they're going to be super strong at something and they're going to be super great on that. And I try to hone in on that. Or one of my students says, you know, I want to go to cosmetology after, or I'm thinking about going to culinary school when I graduate. You know, I'll make sure that I was like, well, we have that at Monmouth Vokes, and you could go when you graduate in the adult program and save your money. And, you know, life is what you make it. So if you look at life as a palette, you know, at times I've had, you know, some things like fell into my lap, and sometimes things were great. And there were some things in my life that happened that, you know, like my dad getting sick, and, you know, financially, my mom had a lot of health issues, and they kind of put bumps in the road, and, you know, or like finances weren't always great. And I just still made it. You know, you still have to just keep going. You know, I tell my students, I was like, things are going to change. You know, one point when I got back from Ireland, actually, when I was in Ireland, I got to talk about this, funny. I said, how do you, there was so many people were like, yeah, I used to work in bartending in New York, you know, the Irish. I go, how the heck do you guys get bartending jobs in New York? Get me a bartending job in New York. I want to make that money, because they made really good money. They still do. And they're like, all right, Deirdre, when you get home, go to Patty Riley's on 2nd Ave. I said, yeah, I know exactly where it is. And ask for Raylene, right? And I said, okay. And say, Kevin sent you. Kevin was from Scotland. I said, I'm going to do that. Brought my mother up there, and I went into Patty Riley's, and I said, when I got home, and I said, I need a job. And they're like, okay, we're hiring. Say you know James Dean. She's like, you know Kevin? I said, yeah. I only worked with Kevin for a year. So I had to go to this bar. She goes, we're not hiring, but this bar on called Barrows, on Hudson and Barrows, hiring. She's like, the owners are like, you know, they kind of look like they're from Goodfellas, like kind of guys. They're not, you know, Irish guys. I said, all right. So I go down there. I say, I know James Dean. James Dean was from Dublin. Never met the guy in my life. They're like, hey, all right, you know James Dean? I said, yeah. Okay. So I got the bartending job right away. So I'm bartending there. I'm actually kind of faking an Irish accent at this point, too. I was like, is this really happening? The girl that's training me is from Jersey City. And we started talking. I said, listen, I'm really from Jersey City. I lived there for a year, but I'm not like, you know. So anyway, James Dean walks in. I call Raylene. I said, who is this James Dean guy? Because I keep lying that I know him. This is a true story. I know things sound so crazy, but it really is a true story. And this is my life. So Raylene's like laughing and she goes, I'll send him down there. So he comes in and he's kind of like, he's a character, still lives in the West Village. And he goes, and he goes, Deirdre, my cousin, how are you? And I was like, hey. And I said hi to him. Don't even know the guy. I started laughing. And so then I ended up bartending before I was teaching. Made great money, by the way. And then I ended up working at a nightclub, too, that was owned by guys from in Dublin. And, you know, got into that scene, which was financially great. I was like 29 years old. It was a blast. And then I started teaching. But my whole point is I was working and I watched this apartment building go up. And I was like, I'll never be able to afford to live there. And it's a beautiful building in Jersey City at the time, because I was working at the Iron Monkey right before like the year I was teaching and I was part-time and all this stuff. And I saw the building go up and the construction workers would come in and I was like, I'll never be able to afford to live there. So I got the teaching job in Teaneck, and that was at a special ed high school. So that I worked there a whole year. And then after that, I got the job at Monmouth Vokes. And I was living downtown. I had a couple different apartments and my mom passed away and she's like, I want you to move back to the city. You always complain about this area. And she hated my boyfriend at the time. She's like, get rid of him and move back to the city. I'm like, all right. And when she passed, you know, I had some money and I fixed up this house, made it a rental. And I moved to that apartment building that I watched. I got a realtor and I moved to that apartment building I watched being built. And I'm like, wow. And it was like, they're like, we have an apartment in here. And I was like, really? And it's pet friendly. And I had a dog and I was like, oh my God, this is great. And I ended up living there for a couple of years. And it was like, but you know, I always tell my students, life changes. Like, you know, you could be working at a restaurant 1 minute and watching this apartment building go up. And a couple of years later, you could be living in that building. If that's a $1 million apartment, you know, like you don't know like how different. And my life has changed so many times over the years and so many different ways. But I have to keep going. You know, I always had to keep going, keep positive. Things are going to get better. You know, you have to have your mindset. And even with art, you know, people always say there's no jobs in this field. I'm like, everything we do is art. You know, everything is graphic design. Look at behind you. Somebody painted that, you know, yeah. Like there is.
I was thinking that looking back there, you know, through the eyes of an artist, you know what I mean? Like you, I mean, I can see you kind of, your gaze kind of scan back there a little bit. So, and I thought about that. There's, yeah, up top, I got, there's a patient of mine that did that Tree of Life with a scroll saw, that freaking graphic, or I did that, that little fish with the open mouth and top shelf at like, you know, one of these pottery places you take your kids. And then that thing of me, that caricature of me was done by a guy that goes by the handle Toxic. I saw some shit that he did, and I saw that he could take a human, like my likeness, and put it, make a caricature out of it.
Yeah.
Like, that's really friggin' cool. And then I was like, hey, make it, you know, kind of like a slash between like a Marine and a doctor. Like, I want you sort of thing. And then my cousin did the Zero Dark 30 thing.
That's cool.
20 years ago, like 20 years ago, he did that. And in all these cases that, well, the freaking fish with the open mouth, I was telling you before, I kind of found the artist in me at freaking 30s, my 30s. Then my cousin who did the Zero Dark 30 graphic, he was like, he would always poo-poo it. I'm like, dude, you really, this isn't work in that capacity. He was a kid that always did freaking cartoons and shit. And he did that for me and I paid him for it. And he's like, no, it's just something I do. And then the guy Toxic, he's clearly very gifted. But he was like, well, just give me this much. Like, it was always like, there's a sense that artists should starve. Like they should be like, you should sacrifice everything for your art. I don't know. It's like a downplaying of this extremely important gift, whether it's music or fine art or any of the various mediums.
See, that's the thing with commercial art. I'm like, no, I tell my students, you need to get paid. You know, I my art like paid for my apartment, paid for my you know, the state of New Jersey pays me to teach this. Like it is paid for things. I sell my fine art now, you know, and as that's what commercial art is. I go, this is the art to get paid. You know, some people do it as crafts and hobbies. You still should get paid for your craft or your hobby. But graphic design and branding, you know, when I worked at Mike Kwan's office, I did a lot of logos for like, you know, huge corporations, Columbia University. I mean, Pfizer was our clients. I mean, all different kinds of, you know, Verizon, the New York City telephone books, like, and I was able to pay for my apartment and pay for my car insurance. And, you know, you have to, you know, understand that, you know, if you do it for free or you downplay it, you're going to hurt other artists, you know, you're going to hurt people. So, you know, I mean, those big clients definitely pay. That's why I always kind of felt good doing stuff in the city. Like I just tried to freelance down here in LBI and somebody tried to get out of paying me. And I was like, you know what? I'm not doing this stuff around here. Like, you know, you got to do I teach my students to do higher end stuff, like, you know, corporate identities and things like that. But, you know, the character behind you is excellent. Like that's a great one, you know? And you know, I did character design. I'm not that good at it, but I tried it. You know, if I wanted to, I had someone, I didn't draw their tattoo the right way on their eye and it was their boyfriend's name. And I was like, I can't do this. It's great.
Hey, you know what I really love, D, is I love artificial intelligence art. That's the best.
You do.
Oh, I'm fucking around with you. I know you don't like it.
I don't like, I mean, it just, okay. As someone who like works in graphics and Premiere and After Effects, and it kind of, okay. I see its place. Like I like it cause it helps me write my lesson plans. Like you could hit AI and you put a sentence in. I'm like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
But, I don't like the art, you know, you see a picture and then it's like always like three hands missing or like, it's always like the hand is like, like, you know, and I'm like, oh, AI. And like, you could tell it's AI. It's almost going to look like, remember how, like when we were kids and we watched like Star Wars and we're like, oh my God. And then like, you watch it like 15 years later, you see like Godzilla and you're like, whoa. And then like 10 years later, you're like, I just feel like we're going to know. We just know it's AI. I don't feel like AI. I think AI might make like animation a little bit easier. That might change that field, I think.
Yeah.
So video graphics, but you know, and maybe it'll whip out things faster, you know, but, people are like, it's going to take over. And I'm like, no, it's not. You can't take over the human mind. Like, I think if anything, it might make fine art more expensive and more better and people want it more.
Yeah.
You know?
There's something in there. Like, I feel like human beings, we are innately makers, right? Our hands, our mind, our personalities, like even our interactions. Like, there's only one Deirdre Callahan.
You know?
There's only one Aaron Oberst. And like, that's the thing, like, you know, and we can circle back, like, you know, there was an expectation in school, in every high school, like it's a pecking order. Oh, what are you doing? What do your parents do? What are you going to do with your life? So to be a normie, it's like, nobody wants to step outside of the mold. Right. But I mean, like I've learned to double down on the eccentricity, you know what I mean? Like, that's what makes you, you.
Yeah.
That's, you know, like how you
all do our life experiences. We all have different experiences in life.
Yeah.
The
nature and nurture of it. But I mean, like, yeah, I mean, there's only one Deirdre Callahan. I wouldn't want to be like, I mean, you might find people that make you want to commandeer an attribute or, hey, I like to be more like her or him or that artist or this person. But, so we cobble together all these different aspects of our personality through our experiences and all that shit. But I don't want to be some straight lace or some friggin' ham and egg, or, you know what I mean? I want to be doing, you know?
Gotta think outside the box.
Yeah, and I think that people like that, where you're talking about growing up in diversity, you know, that colors literally your perspective on everyone you meet, having grown up in the city, having living in the country, having to make sense of it all and find your place. The fact that you alluded earlier to a statement I made about you, which, you know, it meant as a sincere compliment. I remember you always being like, not like trying to be like fit in, you know, oh, I got to be on this crew. You know, I remember you were a cheerleader for a while, right?
Yeah, I was. And then But I mean, was in gymnastics as a kid. So when we moved here, they didn't have gymnastics. So I was like, well, let me do cheerleading. And then I wouldn't do gymnastics because I didn't like, I thought the girls' outfits were too skimpy and I was nervous. I was like, oh, I don't want to wear that.
So, so we're all trying to like fit in. Of course, when we're young, we're trying to like, we're trying to fit in. But I think we soon learn, maybe we get a little bit of experience under our belt that, you know, I'm just going to double down on me and try to do the things that are uniquely me. And I think that's art in a nutshell. Like, how can we shine that on our perspective on the world? And even I'm looking at your shirt there, you know, like if you look in the back, you know, everybody, the viewer, if you look at the, you know, the dreary day that we have going on outside, one thing that really pisses me off is when people like, now I'm not doing it today, I'm traditionally an earth tones guy, but like if it's a overcast day or stormy day, I want to wear something bright.
Yeah.
You know, because I want to somehow try to shine, or the music I play or the friggin' interactions. I don't want people coming in. I'm in my chiropractic office. I don't want people coming into my office moping around. Oh, it's going to rain. April showers bring May flowers. Shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Put on some color, put a smile on your face, and try to, you know, make every day count.
Exactly.
Because life is freaking short.
The older I get, yeah, it really is.
You know? All right, let's wind this down. Tell me about, I'm going to go a speed round. Are you ready for it?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Who is, you said your favorite color is like blues, but as an artist, you change up. Who's your best childhood friends?
My best childhood friends. You know, Barbie Fury, Karen Conlon, Meredith Sterling, such great friends of mine, you know, through like the high school times and stuff. I mean, Lynette, oh my God, been through stuff with Lynette, like, you know, love the girl. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are people as I get older, you know, that I knew as a kid and that came back into my life, you know, so it's like, you know, there are certain people that, yeah, those are the hardcore crew, I would say.
Yeah. If we go to the ice cream lady, she pulls up at the First Lake parking lot, Second Lake.
You mean the ice cream man, Tom Ahon, because he still does that.
He does?
Tom and D's is still here. Yeah.
Nice. Good for him. Talk about living the dream. That's awesome. So you're friggin' at a Second Lake. We're friggin' getting a little swim in there. What the ice cream man comes around? What are you gonna get? What is your favorite ice cream? You're gonna get a Choco Taco. You're gonna get a friggin'
cherry ice.
Like cherry ice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like cherry watermelon or something like that. Yeah. Swirl.
It's fruity. Yeah. Something fruity.
Like fruity. Tom and D's ice. You know. I'm loyal to Tom and D because he dated my friend Meredith in high school.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, very loyal to Tom.
He was always a real nice guy.
Super nice. And, you know, what started, I go to the lake. I don't swim in it because I don't want to get an earache. But I will go to the lakes in the summertime just because if I don't feel like driving to LBI, I'll ride my bike or take my car over there now. And I've been going there every summer and I see Mahon and he'll kind of give me like, you know, hey, guess who died? Or guess who? Now we talk about guess who died. You know, like, I'm like, no way. You know, and as we get older, but like, you know, we'll kind of like talk town, you know, and then, you know, we still got the business.
That's great, man. What's better than being an ice cream man?
I'll get badges this summer. You're invited. You and the kids. Barbecue.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
A lot of history there. Remember walking across the
sandbar
road, the sandbar across the Second Lake.
Yeah.
And that was great. Fishing in there.
I was afraid a snapping turtle would bite my toe off. You know, like
I used to catch them. I caught, true story, me and I think it was Rocco. I caught a big snapping turtle, probably friggin' 2-foot diameter on a bologna sandwich. A piece of bologna sandwich. and I just dragged it in. I thought it was going to have a huge fight. I friggin' saw it out there at surface, and I cast it right on its head, and it bit. And we tried to sell it to the Captain's Inn because they would do snapper soup, but they wouldn't take it. And but I'm glad we let it go. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about a story? Your best story from Caffrey's.
My best story from Caffrey's. Just, you know, being one of the OG waitresses. Like, that's where I learned how to waitress. And I don't know.
Something about a local actually, award.
You know what? I'm going to tell you a great story from Caffrey's. The owner, Tommy Caffrey, said, with a name like Deirdre Callahan, you could get a job at any Irish bar you want to. And that is how I got into the Irish scene in New York. So I was working at Mike Kwan's office. And I was only making $10 an hour. I had to like actually get paid. This is my internship when I was a junior at Moore College of Art. And so I was like, you know what? I remember he said I could get a job at any Irish bar. So right by the train station when I was by Madison Square Garden, there was a Triple Crown Ale House that says hiring. And I was like, that's an Irish bar. So because I saw the Shamrock. So I walk in and the owner is Martin O'Shea. And he goes, oh, yeah, we're hiring. We're hiring. We're looking for a hostess. And he goes, what's your name? I said, Deirdre Callahan. He goes, you're hired. I said, all right. And I saw him next week. And I was so I worked for Mike Kwan's office during the day doing graphics, and to offset, like, you know, getting paid nothing because I was an intern, I worked as a hostess at the Triple Crown Ale House. That started my kick on Ireland. All the girls were from Ireland, and except for me, and I just kind of blended in, like, whatever.
Hmm. What are some themes? You know, it's interesting. I was going to say St. Caffrey's, all these other places you had bartended or worked at in Jersey City. There's some themes. I mean, obviously, people coming together, a lot of beverages flowing, a lot of it takes a certain, you got to be tough, right?
Yeah.
Because there's going to be some characters you're going to encounter in there, and there's going to be fights and all kinds of craziness, you know? All
kinds of crazy. Yeah, it was, you know, usually you just kind of, I don't know. Maybe it was my eye behind my head sometimes with the city. I had nothing, luckily nothing bad ever happened. You know, it was, I guess, cause I don't know, the bar scene in Jersey City was a little interesting. We get a lot of stock workers that would come in. And like I said before, one of the stock workers told me about how in economics, if you study Jersey City, it's the first place that, what happens in the economy nationwide will happen there first.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I want to pass that philosophy to people because it really is, because it's the background in New York. And it's kind of like, so he, you know, that secret of life, I think, is very important because it's, you know, it's very interesting what goes on in that little strange city.
It's a microcosm.
That's yeah.
I'm sorry. So it's like, yeah, everybody dreams, every like financial, whatever, professional dreams of working on Wall Street. So if you're living in Jersey City, presumably, or hitting the town in Jersey City and you're working in Manhattan.
And like a lot of things, like the real estate went up, the rentals are coming in, a lot of, you know, they're pushing people to rent more and making it impossible to buy, all that kind of stuff. But I want to say something about Lacey in Ireland. My childhood in Lacey Township was very close to what an Irish childhood would be, more so than anything in the city. Like, you know, wait, totally. Like Jersey City and Dublin isn't as busy as that city. But Lacey growing up, like with friends and everyone knowing each other, Lacey is Ireland. Ireland is Lacey and like just floating in the Atlantic. Seriously. It's, everyone knows each other. Everyone knows each other's business. Everyone thinks they know each other. Everyone talks about each other. They talk about leaving, how they hate the place. They hate the island when they're in Ireland. They don't want to live there. They want to live somewhere else. But they all come back. It's the same.
That's what I'm talking about.
It's freaking Lacey Township.
That's what I'm talking about. But maybe that's every small town, though. Maybe that's everybody's hometown. Like when I, because, you know, I think I might have shared with you during COVID cooties, I got a couple bunch of books on the Pine Barrens. I'm like, yeah. You know, it's where I'm from. You know, somebody tipped me off. There's something, a book called The Bayman. It's about. Yeah,
I read it. I know exactly what you're talking about.
It was wonderful. You know, it just brought, because I knew guys like my dad had a Garvey made by Sam Hunt, who was like, who was one of the pine coners.
Yep.
He was one of the pine coners. I remember visiting that guy's house, and there was just shit everywhere in his yard. But he could make a Garvey, and we had a Garvey. My dad had a Garvey built. Yeah, I mean, every small town, everybody like dreams of they love where you're from. There's no place like home. But then when you're there too long, you're like, man, I gotta get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone's like, I gotta leave. I hated this place.
Holding me down. All this small time drama shit. You know what I mean?
It's great though. You know, lazy people are great. Like when something happens, like, you know, I got divorced and I was really upset. All my little friends came out of nowhere. You know, like, I mean, I have friends, the Smith girls. They were from Hoboken and they moved here our junior year. So not a lot of people know them, like our age group. And I became best friends and our moms became friends because I was like, wait, where are you guys from? You guys aren't from around here. And they were from Hoboken. So they're very close friends of mine. But, you know, Lacey, what was I going to say about the small town stuff? When something bad happens, they really come together for you. Or if you start a business, like our Lacey crew will come in there and they'll sponsor it, you know? And then once you're doing really good, then they'll like be like, all right, you're fine. Oh, you know, then you don't hear from them.
Yeah.
When shit hits the fan, you know, these lazy people will come through with you, you know. When I went to, you know, I was at my divorce hearing, Lynette came, you know, and then I haven't seen her in a while, you know, maybe like, you know, she's like, Dee's doing good, fine, see you later. You know, like that's how it is, you know, you get on with your life, you get on with your life.
Yeah. But
like, people will really come through for you here. Like there, it's kind of like cool in that small town. And then, you know, you get back to the thing and then everyone gets in their little like, oh my God, did you hear what she said? And then, but, you know, you can't be up here, you know, but when you're down here, people bring you up and then they'll be like, oh, okay.
Yeah, you're good. Well, yeah. Well, you know, there was a, I was just thinking that about my crew, you know what I mean? Like, which you're part of my crew.
I love your crew. Yeah. Your crew was like a huge part of my life.
Yeah. But I'm honored to be on it. I always tell them that I'm honored to still be on a text thread with them. And a lot of it'll be like Mattias showing pictures of the crabs he's catching. Yeah. And they're like, oh, dude, like on some level, I'd love to go back and walk out to Holiday. What the hell is the name of that place? In Ocean Gate, somewhere he goes crabbing and he's taking pictures, beers and barbecue. And some of the other guys are talking shit at each other, all the stuff like that. Anyway, they do. It's like, I'll say, hey, man, I'm sorry I was unable to come in for that. And they're like, and then somebody will text me privately and be like, yeah, listen, none of these guys are around either. They all got their shit going on too. So everybody's got shit going on.
Their life, yeah.
But then when it really matters, because our lives are all busy and stuff like that. But when somebody is really in need or there's a special occasion, then, you know, we all rally behind it, which I think that is very important to do because, as I mentioned earlier, as we've all seen full, especially approaching 50 here, you lose a lot of people.
Yeah, we lost Z. That was...
Yeah. So that sucks ass.
Yeah. You
know, tremendous person and larger than life. And you know, you sometimes see this stuff coming, but most often you don't. And then you say, it's just like 9/11 and where we started, you know, like there's these moments where everybody's like, holy shit, nothing is guaranteed. So maybe we ought to start really being good to one another.
Heck yeah.
So we do that, D. We do that through fucking art, my friend. I think so. And that's why I freaking invited you on this podcast, because I think the world of you. And I think if we can shine our light of goodness and creativity on that dreary day outside or on some kind of hardship or somebody moping around, if we can take them and turn them around, put a smile on their face, then that is art and that is beauty. And that's what makes life worth living, God damn it.
Totally.
All right. Well, I love you like a sister, and I appreciate your time. I appreciate your time. You have any closing remarks?
Just, you know, one day at a time, live your life. All the bad things will turn into good eventually. Never, life is always changing, forever changing. Always do the right thing, and, you know.
How about Irish parables?
I got a good one. Rin Tin Tan Mari Shin Tan Fein. Yeah.
For fuck's sake.
Means there's no fireside like your own fireside.
That's wonderful.
No place like home.
Oh, that's wonderful, Dee. All right. Love and respect. You're going to see, we're going to post this, and all of our Fork and River folks are going to be friggin' tuning in. And
they're we'll like, you know what?
They're like, you're Andrew Callahan talking in here.
He's a dear Callahan's on there.
Yeah. Hey,
where was this picture taken up here?
Oh, that was Kate May with my cousin. That was around New Year's. That was just this year. Yeah.
That's a nice photo.
Thanks.
All right. Listen, this is going to be a great week for us, D. You tell that freaking carpenter in there, I'm sure his work is the finest in all the land. For fuck's sake.
It is. Steve-O is great.
All right. Take care. Nice to meet you, Steve. All right. Take care.
Bye.